Plus 49.
Muy buenas tardes y bienvenidos to another episode of Plus 49. My name is Sigrid Arteaga. I'm so glad to have you with us. This week, we're serving you summer feels and some food for thought. In the news, Mats is already making headlines with his EU summit migration stance, and we look at Germany's doctor shortage and what it has to do with students heading abroad. Our interview guest this week is Johanna. She is an internal communications expert, and she's also married to a German. She shares insights on cross-cultural love and navigating everyday life. Grab your iced coffee or your sunscreen, and let's get started. Let's kick off this week's episode with a look at some major political and social developments in Germany and beyond. First up, Chancellor Friedrich Merz is making waves in Brussels. At his first official EU summit, Merz aligned himself with hardline leaders like Italy's Giorgia Meloni in a push for migration stricter policies. The closed-door pre-summit meeting focused on curbing irregular migration through expanded partnerships with third countries and stricter enforcements of EU asylum rules. Critics warn this could mean more people being sent to so-called safe third countries, even if they've never been there before. Back home, Germany is also facing internal pressure on healthcare and workforce policies. A new analysis shows that over 9,000 Germans, roughly 1 in 10 medical students, are currently studying medicine abroad, mostly in Austria, Hungary, and Bulgaria. The main reason? A shortage of spots in Germany's competitive medical schools. Well, this shows the EU educational mobility in action. Experts warn that there's little data on whether these students will return to practice in Germany. That's troubling, especially as the country faces a growing shortage of doctors, with over 5,000 general practitioners, positions already unfilled. Next, a proposed pension reform package is stirring up debate. Labor Minister Bärbel Bas wants to make it easier for retirees to return to work, eliminating the so-called pre-employing ban, and secure the pension level at 48% until 2031. The package also addresses long-standing inequalities in so-called mother pensions, seeking to equalize benefits for parents of children born before and after 1992. You have probably already heard of The Bachelor. Yes, the one where there's a good-looking guy in a too tight suit and hands out roses and meaningful stares. But few newcomers to Germany realize just how vast the local universe of reality or trash TV truly is. From dating formats like Love Island and Are You the One to competitive couple shows like Sommerhaus, The Stars, German TV offers a smorgasbord of cringe, chaos, and camp. And over the years, this universe has given birth to some truly unforgettable characters. Take Paul Janke, Germany's very first bachelor, who has turned his one-time rose duty into a semi-permanent celebrity status. Or Claudia Obrath, she is a walking champagne flute with a passion of chaos and catchy one-liners. Through sheer commitment to being unapologetically herself, oh my god, that is such a long word, she's gone from French oddity to fans' favorite and a living meme. Currently, The Bachelor franchise is doubling down on drama, literally. The newest season features not only one but two bachelors searching for love, because clearly one man handing out roses just isn't enough. And of course, it's not just about watching. A whole interactive culture has gone around these shows. A few episodes ago, we explored Germany's love for quizzes, and surprise, there's of course trash TV that has entered that arena, and all over the country you can have trash TV pub quizzes that are definitely becoming a thing. Whether it's Matthias Magyapane asking you to name which star threw a drink in episode 3 of Temptation Island, or Calvin Klein changing your knowledge on fake tans and villa drama, fans are loving it. So why does this stuff work so well here? Well, because even highly educated, serious-minded Germans love watching others flirt awkwardly. Of course, they haven't seen themselves flirt. And to be how this awkward backstabbing glee roll or cry in hot tubs. It is an emotional roller coaster of human interactions, served with very good editing, music, and lots of drama. Reality TV offers escapism, social experimentations, and plenty of Schadenfreude. It's not just about laughing about others, though that's of course part of it. It's also about reflecting on how people behave under pressure and then discuss it with your friends like you've just come back from a sociology seminar. Some viewers generally root for love stories. Others are in for the fights, the fashion fails, or the Instagram drama that follows. And with new formats laughing all the time, it's clearly we're all still here for the roses, the tears, and the beautiful edited chaos. Otherwise, just ask Heidi Klum why he has been doing Germany's Next Top Model for over, I don't know, like 25,000 years. And of course, you always start the beginning of the year with the jungle camp. That's also a big thing here in Germany. If you have absolutely no idea what we're talking about, just Google the names. Trust me, you will have a lot of fun rewatching them. Today we are joined by Joanna. She's a fellow communications expert and someone who I met at a great event, and we just clicked, and ever since then we wanted to have this conversation about living in Germany, not coming from Germany, but living with a German husband. Joanna, welcome.
Thanks ever so much. It's lovely to see you again, Sigrid.
So tell us a little bit about how you arrived to Germany.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So I was living in London and working in classical music, and I felt like I wasn't really happy. I wasn't really finding where I wanted to be in terms of industry and work. And so I thought if I go to Berlin, I'd already visited Berlin and really liked Berlin. I spoke bad German. I had a D at AS level when my German teacher said to me, you'll never learn the language properly unless you sit and learn the grammar or move there. And then so I decided, rather than spending my time temping in London and not really knowing what I wanted to do, I would take the opportunity to move to Germany. So I did. That was 13 years ago. I started as an au pair, because that was a really easy transition to know that I would have a house and a job, and it was the worst decision I've made. Didn't last very long, and then within about 3 or 4 months, I met my now husband, which is why I ended up staying for a little bit longer than the 1 to 2 years that was planned. And ever since then, I've built a career in internal communications. I'm now working as a consultant, but I've worked in tech for the last 10 years, bought a house, so I'm not going anywhere. And and I love it. I never thought this would be my life. I never thought I'd be speaking German every day and living in a foreign country for the rest of my life. But so far, so good.
When you move from London to Berlin, because we are talking whatsoever, two capitals, what was like the first things that you realized? Oh, this is A, not really a capital, and B, welcome to Germany.
Yeah, so for me, Berlin's quite small. Everyone always talks about it being quite big. For me, it's not. I always say that London's a bit more like Frankfurt am Main and Berlin put together. And actually also in terms of kind of East London and West London vibes as well. East London's very cool and alternative, and the West is where the money is more and stuff. So I've always described it in that way. In terms of capital cities, I don't know. I mean, Berlin's a new capital city, right? So in that respect, in terms of gentrification, it's really starting now, whereas London, it happened a long time ago, 20, 30 years ago. But actually, I lived in Potsdam in my first year because that was where my au pair job was, and that was where Sebastian was, my husband. And I tried to convince him. I said, I can't live in Potsdam. It's too small for me. Can we move to Berlin? And he said, okay, if we move to Charlottenburg. And then we moved to Charlottenburg, and slowly we've been itching further and further east across across Berlin over our various moves. But it is a capital city, and that's clear. But I think it's definitely a young capital city and much smaller than I was used to in terms of London.
In general, I believe that one of the things that we forget when we move to Berlin is exactly how new it is. Especially if you think that, oh, I'm moving to France or Madrid or even Rome. It's kind of big and loud and has, yes, Berlin definitely has a lot of history. And that part of the gentrification, as you said, is just starting. So it's kind of like, for me, it's also a smaller city. And also, this is kind of the feeling that we've got from internationals when they arrive and they realize that maybe it is not the capital they had in mind before moving here.
I mean, I've been here twice. I came here with my A-level German, which is Abitur, right, in that kind of age, 16, 17. And then I came here again with some girlfriends the year before I moved. So I knew what I was getting myself in for sure. But I also think it's a really great thing in terms of smaller, you know, it's easier to get around. It's people have this really, they look out for each other kind of vibe, which you don't necessarily get in big cities. So I think it has its pluses and minuses. I prefer more direct flights to locations from the airport, and I prefer, but you know, I love the vibe that people look after each other and keep an eye out. And there's a lot of kind of self responsibility in Berlin, which I like, that you maybe don't get in the big cities where it's really hectic.
And I do believe that we're being part of the making of Berlin. This is kind of making some history with Berlin itself.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I'm sure people, lots of people would be unhappy about it as well. You know, I came over and worked in tech, and I'm a classic expat who's kind of accepted rental agreements that are higher up than any local Berliner. So I don't know if I'm part of the story that everyone wants to tell, but I'm, it's funny. I also know like loads of mates who came over who, you know, came over for a kind of bohemian and a freedom and to live this artistic life and have this, you know, and I became more domesticated. I found my career. I met my husband, you know, and in London, I was really more bouncing around and not really sure of what I wanted to do. And Berlin actually gave me this kind of, oh, here's my career. Here's my husband buying property. Here's my kind of future. So I've kind of gone the opposite way than most.
We're back with Joanna. She has been 13 years already in Berlin. Regarding internal communications, just because a lot of people don't know what internal communications is, explain to us and maybe also a little bit about your work in tech and internal communications.
Yeah, sure. So really, internal communications is about ensuring that employees in whatever organization they are understand how their role contributes to the wider company strategy, the values, and what the company is looking to achieve. And in order to do that, they need real clarity on what it is that the company is trying to achieve, on what the priorities are, on how their role fits in, on what the company stands for in terms of values, on any kind of changes that are happening in the organization, pivots to the strategy, pivots to leadership, all of that. And my role really is to give them that clarity and really act as a, I don't know, I would say that I act as an employee advocate in the terms of when I'm in meetings with senior leadership, I'm wearing my employee hat and I'm making sure that their voices are heard. But at the same time, I'm acting as a consultant internally, I guess, and a strategic advisor to mostly the C-suite or senior leaders in how to communicate effectively in the workplace. And that's kind of how I would describe it.
How much does it change internal communications when you have employees from all around the world?
Well, massively, right? I'm an English native speaker, obviously, but it doesn't help me if I'm going to use convoluted words and ways of saying things or use vernacular phrasing or metaphors that don't relate, right? I have to communicate in a way that my audience understands. And that the best way of doing that is simple language. Not only that, but I don't know if you've read the culture map, but there's, you know, it's also about how people receive information and how, I wouldn't say what's the word, it's not traditions, but how people expect to be communicated to and in what ways vary across the world, right? So it can also be a difference in terms of the tools that they use. For example, I've noticed in LATAM and APAC, they're really quick to pick up digital tools, whereas in Germany, for example, less so. And to your point, I've worked in organizations that are 600 people, and now I'm currently consulting for the last 6 months at a company that's 130,000. I'm also working in the US now, which I have never worked in before, which is another great learning And I think it varies. I think there are best practices to be had. There are ways to understand what good looks like and try and leverage those and utilize those in your work in whatever company you're in. But you have to adapt based on your employees, based on where the company is, you know, based on the geographic locations, based on where the company is in terms of, is it going through this startup to scale up phase where there's lots of transition and changes to the culture intrinsically? And or are we a massive DAX listed organization and a regulated in a regulated industry that needs a lot more thoughtful, conscientious internal comms, perhaps, and a lot more approval rounds, for example? So really, it looks different in every phase of a company's life, in every location in a company's life. And you really have to rely on those around you who can support you in making, in helping you understand what that looks like for your employees.
We're back with Joanna, and she's married to a German guy, which means it's not only about the different duvets, but probably there's a lot of things that you have understand about the German culture, not only, well, not only by living here, but also having a roommate husband that maybe has shown you a little bit about the beauties of Germany. Has it been any cultural clashes or understanding around life as an expat with a German citizen?
Yeah, my God, so many. I think the funniest thing is it's only since I've started to follow a few people on like Instagram who kind of talk about these German stereotypes and things that I've realized that it's not just a Sebastian thing. I always think it's just, well, before I always thought it was just my husband. And now I'm realizing, oh, it's a German thing. So for example, he always wants to open windows even, and I don't understand why he wants to open windows when we've spent all this money heating the house to make it warm. And then he just wants to bring in all this cold air, which I think is inefficient and a waste of money. And he says, it's, you know, Luften, you've got to do it. He makes me wash the shower after I've showered in it, which I think with the little squidgy thing, which I think is also, I've just, it's clean water, it's a shower. I don't quite understand that. There's also, he's now much more relaxed in terms of times when we eat, but he's married to an English person, but we've also got friends who are Greek, Spanish, French, American, Australian, English, Hungarian, you know, from all over. And we don't eat dinner at 6:30 every day, and we don't eat lunch at 12:30 every day. So I think these little things, again, I always thought it was just him. I thought it was just Basti, and that was how he was. And actually, it turns out it's more of a thing than just him. But there's loads of things. But I think you just, you know, like any relationship, you try and understand each other and try and get where they're coming from, and then everything is fine. And I think there's a lot of things that I've adapted to myself. For example, I can no longer sleep in a warm bedroom because I'm so used to sleeping in a freezing cold one now that when I go back to England or to a hotel, I'm always opening up the windows.
That was exactly my next question. What thing, the way that you live your life, has now become more German?
Yeah, I mean, back to my point, right? Some of my friends say that I'm a lot more German now because I'm punctual and I'm more direct. The one thing, I don't know if there's one thing. I think, no, I don't really know if there's one thing, to be honest. I do just think that you naturally kind of adapt. Thank goodness I haven't got a German accent yet, but we speak German at home, right? So we also converse in German. So for me, it's been a brilliant way to learn the language. It's also meant that our arguments are much shorter because I don't always have the vocabulary to keep going. But I think when you immerse yourself fully in the culture and the language as well, you can often really not see it in yourself, and it takes other people to kind of call out what's changed in you, really.
I mean, at the end of the day, everyone of us ends up getting something out of this cultural experience. And we have had some guests that said that, oh, now they do walks at any point in their days and just enjoy it. Something that before it was just like, why? Why are you walking without any purpose? You're like,
yeah, I mean, I'd take a taxi to the toilet if I could. So I'm the worst person to ask about going for walks, really. But yeah, there's that. The one thing I really wish I could do, I wish I could open a beer on anything. And the amount of people that are trying to show me with a lighter, with whatever, I mean, just, I'm just so jealous because it's taken me 13 years and I still haven't managed to work out.
That is a German superpower, definitely. I think at some point, Marlene should start giving us some introductions and how to open things just by seeing that, because it's really amazing how, yeah, they can basically with a key, of course, with the teeth, that is very hardcore for me, even though, I mean, this is Berlin and people do that, but it's still very hardcore for me.
Don't try this at home, kids. You need a disclaimer underneath your podcast.
Yes, definitely. We're in our last segment with Joanna. Do you think C-levels understand the importance of internal communication and intercultural communication?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. I think at least in my experience, every C-level that I have worked with has done, but then they've hired me. So if you hire me as an internal comms director, you know, you must understand to a certain extent the influence and the impact that someone in my position can hopefully have in the organization. What I would say is more the challenge. There's an education piece for a lot of employees around internal comms and what we do. A lot of what we do isn't always visible. Sometimes the best work we do is preventative and therefore not visible at all, right? But also I think some in my last permanent role, for example, there was some heartburn around, am I a puppeteer for the C-level? Are we becoming more corporate? Do we have this now kind of mouthpiece that isn't going to tell us the truth? And so there's a lot of education work, I think, with employees based on their experiences in general, right? But with C-level generally, my experience is absolutely. However, in times of crisis, in times of when there's just a huge amount of operational decision-making to be done and or something that is hugely impactful or risky for the organization, they need to know that they can rely on internal comms to deal with that and that they don't have to think about that while they're busy doing all of their other things.
We were also talking about, like, sometimes as an international, you feel a lot of things personal. We have had in previous programs that one of the things that Germans really do is be very straightforward, and that Berlin teaches you and Germany teaches you not to take things personally. And that is the best way to just say, like, oh, it is nothing wrong with me. It is just the way that things happen in Germany. And maybe, Joanna, I don't know, do you have any other examples or things that you would mainstream situations?
Customer service, that's a massive one in terms of Germany, or particularly Berlin. It's improved loads and it's so much better. But when I first arrived 13 years ago, I remember being in a restaurant thinking, am I inconveniencing this person by asking for food, you know? So I think it varies, but I also think it's different ways to demonstrate care and different ways to demonstrate manners, and it's different ways to demonstrate your relationships. And I think it's just different. It's not worse. If I think about manners in terms of, I think Germans say please less as a language than English people do, and they definitely say sorry less because English people say sorry way too much. But then I've always met German men who will open the door for me or who will give me their coat or will let me on the train first. So I think manners and ways of interacting with people and ways of speaking to people do vary on culture, and it's not necessarily a good or a bad or a way of doing it. It's just different. But if you ask some of my friends now in the UK, they'll say I've become more German. And I think what that means is I'm more direct. I think I say sorry less. And I'm always on time, and I never used to be.
I think it's really interesting seeing on how these different ways we are and we react to certain things. And I think we can talk a lot longer about this, but for now, I think we have to come to an end. But before we go, maybe you can tell us where we can find you.
I'm on LinkedIn. My name is Joanna Schild. You can find me on linkedin.com/IN/Joanna-Schild, I think. Yeah, if you want to follow me on LinkedIn, I'd love to see you there.
Thank you so much, Joanne, for being with us today.
You're more than welcome, Sigrid. It's great to see you again. Thank you for having me. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Plus 49. Ask a German.
I would love to better understand Germans' obsessions with Späti beers and a little bit more around Späti culture.
If you've ever spent any time in Berlin, chances are high you've stumbled across or out of a Späti. These small late-night shops, short for Spätverkauf, are more than just a place to grab a club mate or emergency roll of paper. They're part of the soul of the city. And yes, while Berliners might act chill about most things, they get very passionate when it comes to their local Späti. So, what exactly is a Späti? Think convenience store, social hub and neighborhood watch all rolled into one. They're open when most other places are closed, often until late at night or even around the clock. You'll find snacks, drinks, tobacco, flowers, chewing gum, lighters, rolling paper and yes, that one lonely frozen pizza. But what truly makes a Späti special isn't what's inside the fridge. It's what happens out front. Whether it's a quick solo stop or a long night with friends on fold-out chairs, Spätis are a kind of living room for the whole Kiez. The roots of the Späti go back to East Germany, where they were known as Spätverkaufsstellen. After reunification, the concept made its way across Berlin and the name Späti took hold. So much so that it was officially added to the Duden in 2017. You'll find similar shops in other German cities, like Bütchen in Düsseldorf or Wasserhäuschen in Frankfurt, but not quite have the same cultural significance as the Berliner Späti. And it's not just about convenience. Spätis are often family-run and serve as a kind of unofficial community center. You might run into your neighbors, hear local gossip, or end up watching a football match on the tiny TV behind the counter. Some even double as post offices or offer free Wi-Fi. But all is not well in Spätiland. Since 2016, tighter rules on Sunday trading have hit Spätis hard, with around 800 forced to close. Creative legal loopholes have been proposed, like turning Spätis into charging stations for e-bikes to classify them as fuel providers, but so far no permanent fix has emerged. Still, despite the bureaucratic headaches, like everything in Germany, the Späti remains a Berlin icon. And it's not just about beer and chips. It's about community, spontaneity, and that feeling that even on a quiet Tuesday night, something might still happen. So next time you pass one, stop in. You're not just buying a drink, you're tapping into a very Berlin tradition.
That's a wrap up for this week's episode of Plus 49. A big thank you to Johanna for joining us and offering her insights into life between cultures, finding a home, and the little things that help us feel grounded. Also, thank you very much to Marlene, who makes this program happen. If you have missed any part of our conversation or want to explore more stories like this, then head over to our website, www.plus49.de. It's all there, along with interviews, tips, and tools for life in Germany. We'll be back next week with more voices and views from the expat side of Berlin. Until then, be kind to yourself, stay curious, and maybe text that friend you've been meaning to. Hasta la próxima!